Away with Words, Part 3, Lecture 14. Fight, fight, fight. For English. For English?
Fight, fight, fight for English.
For English? Well, that's what I'm going to be talking about in this lecture. And I've saved the political part of this course for the very end for a couple reasons. The first is, if you end up not liking this political part, hopefully you'll still have learned a whole lot about grammar from the first 13 lectures, and so you'll still be pretty happy. But the second thing is, a lot of grammar books, a lot of discussion of grammar and of linguistics start with the political and social aspects and then go on to the other stuff. And I don't think that's as effective as starting with the technical material, figuring out how grammar works, and then slotting it into its political and social and cultural roles. So, this is another manifestation of the drought way of grammar. Before we get all worked up about whether the prevalence of split infinitives is a sign of the apocalypse and the impending decline of Western civilization and no one knows how to write anymore, it's useful to know what infinitives are and what it means to split them and why or why not you might want to split them. Then you can talk about what the symbolic or political or cultural meaning of these things is. And that's why we wanted to look at all this technical material first. And it's a lot of technical material. If you followed along with this course, you now know a ton about grammar and a lot about the most sophisticated, complex, and contemporary approaches to language, as well as all the old school stuff going back to why G-H-O-T-I spells fish. We've really put it all together. And we've got a few principles then that we can look at. The first is the principle that things that seem messed up in English usually have rules behind them. The more messed up they are, the more likely that there's a complex history, and that the English language is layered. There's one layer on top of another layer on top of another layer, like a road in a very old part of the world, a Roman road in London or East Street and where I live in Dedham, when there's different layers and none of those layers were necessarily completely removed before the next layer was put on. So that's what we have in English. We have, going back to Proto-Indo-European, we have Celtic, we have Latin, we have Anglo-Saxon, we have Danish, we have French, we have Greek and Latin, all layered together, making a very complex system. And this complex historical system points us to where we want to go with this lecture, which is talk about the social and cultural side of grammar. Because history is something that happens to human beings, and human beings engage in politics while they're creating history. And so this is the part of the course where we talk about the social side to grammar. I mean, think about this. Language and grammar evolved for the vast portion of their history. You might even say the whole portion, but I think that you could make the argument that sometimes grammar and language are a solitary activity when you're just writing a poem for yourself or something. But in general, they are very social activities. And the need to communicate with other people is what keeps language from just being private babbling. I mean, you can decide that you want the word whoopelgork to mean red panda, and for you, it might mean red panda. But if you want to communicate with anybody else, you run up against the necessity of having a shared language system. Let me emphasize that. Language system has to be shared. It has to be social, or you're not going to be able to communicate, and there's not really much of a point. By the way, James Joyce, for example, pushed this to its absolute limits in Finnegan's Wake, where he sort of invented a private language system using English. He had hidden meanings and things that were meaningful to him. Or you could take it like J.R.R. Tolkien, making up his own languages because he wanted something for his elves to speak, or actually made up the elves so that they could speak the languages that he'd made up. But really, in general, you have to communicate with other people. So on the one hand, although it may seem surprising that I titled a lecture Fight, Fight, Fight for English, maybe we shouldn't be surprised that there's a fight over grammar. There are fights over all kinds of things that are social. And when I say fight, I mean, you know, a contest, a political struggle, a set of disagreements. We're human beings. That's how we resolve differences, hopefully without killing each other, but instead by arguing over grammar. You say, yes, but grammar? Come on. Do people really care that much about grammar? Of course they do. Language is probably the single most important element in defining human identity. And if it's not the most important thing, it is up there. I would say that in some circumstances, language can be more important than national identity. The language group you belong to within your nation may be more of a determinant of your identity than membership in the large nation. I mean, just think of the situation in Kosovo today, where there are people speaking different languages, ethnic minorities. The language is one of the things that separate them. Now, thankfully, the stakes aren't quite so high in the fight over English grammar. No one is yet, and hopefully ever, killing other people or fighting with other people physically because they want to say split infinitive should be in the language or not. And this may be the case because the larger battles between languages themselves, in other words, like the argument over what shall be the official language of the United States and should there be a sole language and so forth, they might take away some of the energy that would otherwise be used to argue passionately about grammar. But there's still no shortage of people who really, really, really care about grammar. Now, I'm an English professor. I'm thrilled about this. The more people that care about grammar, the better. When Lynn Truss's Eat Shoots and Leaves, which is about punctuation mostly, not even like all the big other things in grammar, just punctuation. When it sold millions of copies, that's a good thing for people in my profession, and it's a good thing for me. I'm just jealous. I want my own best-selling book with a panda on the cover. But it is a great thing. And it's only about stinking punctuation. I mean, think if it were about something even more interesting, though I love punctuation. Well, one reason then that this is so important is not just the intrinsic interest of punctuation, but because the subtleties of grammar and of punctuation are in fact linked to, or they are markers for, identity. Let me tell you about the great linguist William Labov, or Labov. I've heard both, but I'm pretty sure it's Labov. Labov studied language in the inner city and on Martha's Vineyard. And he actually got paid to spend a summer on Martha's Vineyard, wandering around, recording people, and listening to their dialects. I mean, I never get gigs like this. No one ever suggests, Drought, go to a nice vacation area for the summer and talk to people. But, you know, maybe things were easier back from the time when Labov did this. Anyway, he made the most of it because he made some brilliant discoveries about language and proved it to pretty much everyone's satisfaction. Okay, in Martha's Vineyard, there is a very distinctive Martha's Vineyard accent. And in fact, it's so distinctive that I can't do it. It'll just sound like generic fake Boston accent, so I'm not going to try. But there is a very distinctive Martha's Vineyard accent. As Labov walked around the island and listened to people and recorded their accents and interviewed them and found out things about them, that was his genius too. He wasn't just collecting sounds. He was collecting social information and stories. He started to classify people into three groups. The first group were people who had never really left Martha's Vineyard for any significant portion of time. We're not saying that they'd like never actually left the island to go to the mainland, but they never lived anywhere else permanently. That's the first group. The second group were people who had left Martha's Vineyard and had lived somewhere else for a while and then had come back. And the third group were people who had not yet left Martha's Vineyard but were planning to. They were going to move to the mainland, get some different opportunities, change things. So we had these three groups of people. And here was the hypothesis that I think was probably in the background. I don't know if Labov's thinking, but pretty much anyone else who had worked on this stuff. They would have said, well, the people who have never left Martha's Vineyard should have the strongest accent because they've never been exposed to anything else. And the people who have left and then come back should have the weakest accent, because they've been exposed to different speech communities. They've heard different things, and different things would have rubbed off on them. Totally makes sense. Totally wrong. Turned out to be entirely the opposite. And Labov was shocked and discovered something really important. The people with the strongest Martha's Vineyard accents were the people who had left Martha's Vineyard, lived for a while somewhere else, and then chosen to come back. Their accent was stronger than either the people who had never left and were never intending to, or the people who had never left but were intending to. Now, wait a second. The changes in accent should be based on exposure to other people. That's not what Labov found. And his solution was brilliant in its simplicity. He concluded that people's accent was not something that they couldn't help and would only change because they were exposed to different accents, but that it was a matter of social choice. And the people who were planning on leaving the vineyard, but actually hadn't done it yet, were already stopping speaking in the full Martha's Vineyard accent and were reducing their accent. And the people who'd gone away, but then came back because they loved Martha's Vineyard so much or because they didn't like where they lived, they put on an even stronger accent. And the reason for this is it was a sign, maybe even unconscious, that they were showing extreme solidarity with their linguistic community. Since Labov, linguists have documented this tendency over and over and over again, and I discuss it in much more detail in my recorded books course in the history of the language. But this is called the language of solidarity. You speak in the accent, or you speak in the form, or you use the grammatical markers of the people that you're surrounded by. And it's not because you can't help it, but it's because you choose to, because you're emphasizing solidarity. Now, there's another countervailing pressure on that as well. There are what we would call prestige accents. In Massachusetts, for instance, there's a Boston Brahmin accent, which has just about died out, which is incredibly distinctive. And this is associated with old, old money, like people whose fortunes were based on whaling or trade with China in clipper ships and things. You can still hear this accent occasionally if you go to the Boston Athenaeum for tea and listen to some of the old men there, or some of the older women also. This is a really high prestige accent. Another high prestige accent is Upper Midwest educated English, which is what national newscasters usually use. When I was in journalism school, we were taught that the prestige newscaster accent was that of Grosse Pointe, Michigan. And it's pretty close. I can tell a newscaster from a normal person from Grosse Pointe, but you can also see where some of that's coming up. Upper Midwest, kind of bland compared to other regional accents because it's highly educated and pretty, the English word would be posh, that's not exactly what we mean, pretty elite. Now, it's interesting to note, by the way, that although this is the accent that you learn in journalism school when you're supposed to have no accent, the accent that you learn is the no accent accent. The major newscasters recently, Dan Rather, for example, had a mild Oklahoma accent, and Peter Jennings had a mild Canadian accent, which is slightly different from Upper Midwest Michigan and is a lot closer to Upper Midwest Minnesota. So maybe having like just a slightly different variation makes you stand out. But in any event, that's the prestige accent. Well, one of the questions we might think about is, why doesn't the prestige accent just crush everything in its path and make us all sound the same because we're speaking like the elites? Why don't we all sound like Boston Brahmins or newscasters? Labov's research explains this in part. The prestige accent doesn't take over everything, turning us into one homogeneous accent community, because there's a trade-off between the politics of prestige and the politics of solidarity as expressed through accent and language. So, for example, in the 2008 presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton got severely criticized when she supposedly put on a fake southern or rural accent when she was speaking to people in the South or speaking to people in rural locations. Now, why would she do this? Hillary Clinton has a prestige accent. She's from the Upper Midwest, from Illinois, and she went to school at Wellesley and then at Yale Law School. She's got a prestige accent, but solidarity with people is important when you're trying to convince them to vote for you. And it's also a trade-off. On the one hand, you want to express solidarity with people, show that you're on their side. On the other, you want to show that you're an elite. And a presidential candidate really has to walk a tightrope on this. And for Hillary, it kind of didn't work for her in those particular cases because she wasn't really from the South or from rural America. And her accent that she put on was just like dropping the G's off of every word. So I'm trying hard to make things right for you. It just didn't sound right because it wasn't natural to her. But you can see why she was doing it. If you're trying to sell someone a car, solidarity is probably a more effective route. If you listen to a lot of sports radio, which sadly I do, you'll note that ads for things like cars, where people want your trust, tend to use strong regional accents, even middle and lower middle class rather than upper middle class regional accents. Ads for national brands or for things like medicine or investments use people with prestige accents, sometimes even use people with British rather than American accents to indicate prestige. So there's this constant trade-off between using prestige forms and using solidarity forms. Now, this is where we're going to build up to the fight for English, because note that not everybody can use the prestige forms, or the solidarity forms for that matter, because you often have to be born into a specific community, be part of an elite community, or have an elite education, or at least have special training. If you spend your whole life in one community, it can be difficult to develop other accents without sounding fake. And that's what Hillary Clinton found out. She hadn't spent enough time living in the South or living in a rural location, and she couldn't make that accent happen for her. Well, grammar is like accent. It's just easier to see an accent in the U.S. But grammar is a lot like accent. It's also different for a variety of reasons. The biggest difference is that grammar is more easily represented by writing, and thus it's more easily taught across wide ranges. Accent isn't. As we noted back in the lecture on spelling, English has this very limited range of letters to express a wide range of sounds. And our alphabet is particularly impoverished where it comes to vowels. And most accents are shaped by the pronunciation of vowels. So we can't use written text to teach accent very well. In fact, getting a new accent sometimes requires you to physically move and immerse yourself in a new culture. And historically, that's difficult and expensive to do. It changed a little bit with the advent of radio and television, but it's still very hard. So we can't really teach prestige accents to everyone, but we can try to teach prestige grammar, and that's exactly what we do in many cases. And this really bothers David Crystal, the author of the anti-Lynn Truss panda-covered grammar book, The Fight for English, How Language Pundits Ate, Shot, and Left. Now, as I pointed out, Crystal is an immensely distinguished British linguist. I have his books on my shelves at home. I use them for teaching and for research. He's very upset, though, that the new focus, as he sees it, on being a stickler in grammar could have some bad effects. And he thinks that this focus is illustrated by the huge success of Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, that there's a lot of potential sticklers out there who could be oppressive and they could undo all the years of work that he and other descriptive linguists have accomplished, particularly in Britain. So in The Fight for English, Crystal points out that there's a very, very long tradition of trying to improve people's natural grammar. And he puts improve in scare quotes to improve their natural grammar by trying to make their grammar conform to the particular cultural practices of the elite. So if the elite say no prepositions at the ends of sentences, even though that's completely natural for English, well, you have to follow that rule if you want to be elite also. The analogy would be trying to make everybody speak the prestige accent. And now this is particularly insidious to Crystal because the elites don't have to do any work. It's one of these rich get richer things. If you're born into an elite accent community, you just talk normally. Everyone else has to try to figure out how to speak just like you. And that, as he would say, I think perpetuates privilege and all kinds of things that he doesn't like. Especially noxious to Crystal is a book written in 1795. So this is the kind of memory grammarians have. Now, especially noxious is a book written in 1795 by Lindley Murray. Lindley Murray was a New York lawyer who then retired to England and wrote a grammar book. And Murray's book, English Grammar, is to Crystal what garlic is to vampires. I honestly think if I had a copy, I could chase him around if I needed to. The thing is that this book in 1795 was enormously influential for various and strange and luck reasons and bits of history and so forth. It was published in 1795 and it sold over 20 million copies over many, many years. Crystal calls it the Eats, Shoots, and Leaves of its day, but that's not really fair. Lindley Murray's English Grammar was set up to tell people this is what you must do, and it has a little bit in common with Lynn Truss's stickler thing, but it's not funny or amusing like Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, so he's being a little mean and unfair there. But pretty much all school grammars of English from 1795 through the 1950s, think about that. You're talking hundreds of years. All of those school grammar books can trace their ancestry back to Murray's tome. Well, so why is this bad? You know, so it's Lindley Murray wrote a book. It was popular. Why are you all just so jealous? Well, the reason is that Murray didn't actually know a lot about grammar, but he knew what he liked. And his vision was imposed upon countless schoolchildren who were actually, as I pointed out before, beaten for violating certain grammar rules. Let me give you an example. Murray didn't like prepositions at the ends of sentences. Why? Because the great English writer John Dryden didn't like prepositions at the ends of sentences, because that wasn't like Latin. And why didn't Dryden like them? Because a preposition is a preposition, should go at the head of the prepositional phrase, and more importantly, you couldn't put a preposition at the end of a sentence in Latin, and since Latin's the best language, obviously, you have to imitate it. Now, let me point out that Chaucer puts prepositions at the ends of sentences. Shakespeare puts prepositions at the ends of sentences. To be or not to be, Hamlet's famous soliloquy, does it twice, including the famous line, "And by sleep to say, we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to." Dryden himself put prepositions at the ends of sentences, though he decided this was a mistake and wished he hadn't done it. So, on this faulty analogy to Latin grammar, which I've already mentioned before, we know why now that we can put prepositions at the end of sentences. Transformations. But on this faulty analogy to Latin grammar, we have tormented students for centuries. Let's follow the drought way for a second and figure out what the problem is, and then we'll get back to the fight for English. Now remember, normally a prepositional phrase is headed up by, you remember, a preposition. In fact, to make a prepositional phrase, we take a noun phrase, we slap a preposition at the beginning. So how does that preposition get to the end? Through transformations. Let's take the Shakespeare sentence, transform it back. The flesh is heir to the thousand natural shocks. Well, that would be the declarative sentence. We turn that sentence into an embedded clause through a transformation, which is exactly what Shakespeare did, making the sentence, the flesh is heir to the thousand natural shocks, into a noun phrase. The thousand natural shocks, that flesh is heir to. That's embedded in a verb phrase, by say. We don't have space here to do all the transformations, but they're perfectly ordinary and reasonable, and they end up with the preposition at the end of the sentence because that preposition's noun phrase has been grabbed and pulled out and moved to a different spot. It's not ungrammatical. It's completely grammatical. But because Murray, Dryden, and many, many others did not know about transformations because they weren't invented until the 1950s, and because they were working with this bad analogy of Latin good, other things bad, they imposed a completely inappropriate rule. Okay, so far so good. I'm with Crystal, that condemning split infinitives and prepositions at the ends of sentences is stupid. And I'd even go along with him and say that it can be oppressive. People can stop splitting their infinitives and stop putting prepositions at the end of the sentence through training. And that training works much faster if you're allowed to beat the students, by the way. But who cares? Well, here is where Crystal and the drought way part company. Crystal goes against the pundits and the grammar mavens because he's worried about oppressive effects of imposing grammar rules on people or on looking down on them for their use of non-standard, non-prestige rules. But he's really embarking on what I think is a crazy utopian project, and I just don't see it happening. And that's the very thing that he is most proud of. He and a big committee of all the best people. And they really were a bunch of really smart linguists and university professors and educators, people who really knew what they were talking about with language, were able to change the official guidelines for BBC pronunciation and the official curriculum for the British school system so that language instruction would not be so oppressive and would take people's variations more into account, would be helpful. And this just fills me with horror. Even though various committees of people with the best intentions base their decisions on pretty sound understanding of the language, it makes my flesh crawl. And here's the political part of this course. I am obviously, by my accent, by my grammar, American. And I find it really dismaying that Crystal is most proud of the British national curriculum in English. Because to me, this sounds like something out of George Orwell. There's some central body made up of committees with the very best people sitting on them. How do you decide that is one of the problems. And they make the best compromises and just, ugh. Again, to my American brain, the potential for even worse oppression is huge. So Somebody decides what's okay and what's not, and then the whole thing gets imposed nationally? I mean, come on. If you've ever been on a committee, you would share my distrust. What's really the best thing is not always the thing the committee decides. Sometimes people are convinced by lots of dumb and bad things. So, Crystal thinks that there's been real progress made in Britain in the teaching of English, and that that progress is really jeopardized by sticklers and zero-tolerance people like Lynn Truss and her millions of readers. Because these people, if you gave them a chance, they would force everyone to follow arbitrary conventions about not splitting infinitives, for example, or using apostrophes for possession and not for plurals, or not ending sentence with prepositions. And these would disadvantage some groups of people who grew up in different circumstances. You know, it's true. I understand where he's coming from. But on the other side of it, the sticklers and the zero-tolerance people are good preservers of certain traditions. They slow down language change, and that could be a good thing. Slowing down language change just a little bit, not stopping it forever, means it takes longer for our grammar books to go out of date, means it takes longer for your training to go out of date, means that you can read older things more easily. I think those are good things. Now, Crystal believes that his committee is better informed than tradition. And I just don't know. I mean, tradition, the mills of tradition, they grind slow, but they grind very, very, very fine. And there is something to be said for getting grammar to conform somewhat with past styles, with the style that's been around for a while. If for no other reason also, then it makes innovation, when you innovate as a writer and change from the traditional style, it makes it more obvious, it makes it stand out, and you can decide if it's good or bad. So that's kind of how I feel, but I'm going to show you I'm a little bit still sitting on the fence, because I find the idea of the National Curriculum for English and the BBC Guidelines for Pronunciation kind of horrible and borderline totalitarian, despite all the efforts of really good people like Crystal. But my daughter happens to go, by pure luck, to one of the British schools in the United States. And this school uses the British National Curriculum for teaching reading and writing. And I have to tell you, it is superb. It works better than any other curriculum that I've looked at, and I've investigated them. It teaches kids to read and write so much better than regular American school curricula. And so I have to think, Crystal really did something right when he helped write this thing. Interestingly, though, as superb as this national curriculum is at the lower grades and vastly superior to most American cobbled-together systems, by the time you get to the upper levels, there's really no difference. And in fact, the British system may be a little worse, particularly at the high levels and the university level. And nobody really knows why. So anyway, despite the good things about the British National Curriculum, I still really remain troubled by it. And I think it's a long-term mistake to try to impose tolerance, just as it's a long-term mistake to impose absolute no deviations, zero tolerance from things. I can't stand that word in Truss's title, except that I'm 90% sure she means it as a joke. The irony here is that Crystal's rules are meant to be increasing tolerance, but they're really just another set of rules. And then there's my skepticism about the Utopian project anyway. Crystal seems to think that if BBC announcers now speak in a variety of regional accents, and if the national curriculum no longer encourages teachers to beat children for speaking Welsh, I'm again not making this up, we're moving towards tolerance of linguistic difference. I'm not so sure. I think what you may be doing is crippling individual people at the service of a larger project. It would be really nice if Crystal was right, and if we would stop paying attention to stupid markers of grammar. But, I mean, seriously, we're talking about human beings. When are people going to stop being prejudiced about something? Maybe sometime in the future, maybe when you and I and our kids and our students are old and gray, people won't care about grammar or accent, but I doubt it. And you and I and our kids and our students, we need to live now. And that means we might need to use prestige grammar or prestige accents to get our own way about stuff. And that might even help us change the world in the way that Crystal wants. And this is where I came up with the red panda and the drought way of grammar. We aren't going to take the side of either of those two big black and white pandas that are wrestling. We're certainly not going to adopt the moronic Lindy Murray approach to hardcore, zero tolerance, beat the students about variations on stupid things. It just means to me that you're not thinking, you're just following rules. But we're not going to go the other direction either. We're not going to give up on traditional grammar. We're not going to give up on distinctions that are useful or important. We actually care about dangling participles because they confuse people. We actually care about I and me because they confuse readers. We care about where the commas in the sentence go because we want our readers to understand things. And so we're going to learn the rules, and we're going to figure out which ones to follow. So we'll be like the red panda. We're certainly not a bear, but we actually aren't a bleeping raccoon either. We're our own thing. We learn the rules, and we learn the reasons behind the rules, and then we decide on a case-by-case basis which rules we need to follow in which situations, and which we can safely ignore, and when. We'll recognize that sometimes we need the politics of prestige, and other times we need the politics of solidarity, and we'll try to figure out when to use them appropriately. We'll be more lenient in judging other people as long as we think that those others are making enough of an effort to be respectful to us by trying to do things the right way, by meeting us halfway. And here, I'm going to quote Marcus Aurelius, who expresses what is to me the proper attitude toward grammar. Listen to what he says he learned from Alexander Grammaticus. See, we've got that Grammaticus title again, and I really think I should be able to apply somewhere to get the title of Michael Grammaticus. But listen to what Marcus Aurelius said he learned from Alexander Grammaticus. Not to be captious, nor in carping spirit find fault with those who import into their conversation any expression which is barbarous or ungrammatical or mispronounced, but tactfully to bring in that very expression that ought to have been used by way of answer or in support of the assertion or by some other graceful reminder. Okay, Marcus was the emperor of Rome, and he could have you crucified if you disagreed with him, but it's still a very reasonable and gentle approach, and if Marcus the emperor could do it, then we can do it too. And so I'm taking Marcus Aurelius and his teacher, Alexander Grammaticus, as the real originators of the drought way of grammar. They were doing it way back in ancient Rome. So how will we all achieve the drought way? How will you achieve the drought way? Well, by listening to this course, of course. And also by continuing to learn. And most of all, by recognizing that grammar's not just a set of tedious rules you can use to torment students or prove your superiority, but it's a glorious creation of the human mind. By studying grammar, we learn who we are. We learn how our minds work. We learn how the logical systems of the universe work. I thought that maybe I was going to end this course with a sentence that had a preposition at the end, or maybe just split an infinitive right there just to show that I could. But instead, I'm going to just end it with a little question. What could possibly be more interesting than that?
This ends Lecture 14. Now that you've completed this course, be sure to test your comprehension by taking the final exam. You'll find the exam on this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com. If you enjoyed this program, the Modern Scholar series from Recorded Books offers courses in a variety of subject areas taught by the world's greatest professors. Call 1-800-636-3399 or visit the course's webpage for a free catalog. This course, produced by John J. Alexander, is copyrighted 2008 by Recorded Books, LLC. The lecture text is copyrighted 2008 by Michael D.C. Drought. The lectures were edited under the direction of Ian McCulloch.